Take your Bible and turn to 1 Peter chapter 5, and we will get there in a few minutes. Now, by the way, if this is your first time here, we are so glad that you've chosen to worship with us today. If you need more information about what a fellowship church is all about, I encourage you to go out on the east end, the west end of the Commons. I get this backwards all the time when I change from auditorium to auditorium, but it's all west is always west, right? Yeah. All right, so on the west end of the auditorium, there's an information center, and there's a lot of friendly people there that can help you with your questions. And hey, if you've been coming for a while and you're ready to plug in, you want to know about membership or baptism or serving in some capacity in the church somewhere, plugging into a small group, stop by the Next Step table on the east end of the Commons, and some friendly people will be there to help you as well. Now, one of the things we want you to know about us is that most Sunday mornings, you'll find that we are teaching our way through whole books of the Bible, and we're about 2 weeks away from finishing up our study through the book of 1 Peter, which is actually a letter. So what was this letter all about? Well, the Apostle Peter is writing to some people that he calls exiles. These are people that got, they're Christians that got kicked out of Rome, and they've made their way to an area that we today call the country of Turkey. And they're living in all kinds of different communities there, and they're being shamed and ridiculed and marginalized and ostracized because of their faith in Jesus. And we've been saying that the situation the church in this country finds itself in today parallels the experience of those early Christians. Over the course of our study in 1 Peter, we've been coming to grips with the fact that Christianity is being pushed from the center to the margins of our national life. And really, it's been kind of a seismic shift just here in the past 20 years or so, because our culture it has and is becoming more and more hostile to the beliefs and values that most of us hold. And the new reality for the church in this country is that it is no longer fully integrated into the culture, and this is going to grow more and more acute in the decades ahead. And just like the exiled church in the days of the Apostle Peter, the church in exile today faces ever-increasing ridicule and insults and opposition because Christianity is not just viewed as wrong, but in some circles, in growing circles, it's viewed as dangerous. Now, it is true that the fiery trial we're experiencing today in this country, it pales in comparison to what Christians face in other parts of the world. And Jim has talked about that the last couple of weeks. But still, this is new territory for us, and that makes it especially hard for us to get our minds around and accept. And what we need most of all is God's perspective on this whole thing. And so in chapter 4, verse 19, the Apostle Peter gives us the perspective we need. He says, "Let those who suffer according to the will of God entrust themselves to a faithful Creator in doing what is right." Entrust yourself to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. And all through this letter, he's told us what right and good looks like. Like in chapter 1, he says that we should fix our hope on the coming of Christ. He's told us twice, don't go back to living like people that don't know God. Don't live like people who don't know God. Don't get assimilated into the dominant culture of the day. He's told us to submit to the governing authorities of our day, the very ones that are making life harder for us. He's told us how that we are to relate to one another in kindness and with having a fervent love for one another. But now, as he turns the corner into chapter 5, he gets more specific in his instructions. Now, chapter 5, verse 1, notice that chapter 5 begins with the word so, or therefore. And that means that he's continuing the previous thought from chapter 4, verse 19. He's carrying the idea, the application of 4:19 forward, meaning, and you could put it in the form of a question. The question is, what does it look like for leaders and followers to entrust themselves to God and to continue to do what's right in tough times? What does it look like? How do we live and lead in tough times? That's what Peter is going to talk about. And he answers that question with three imperatives, three commands that are found in verses 1 through 7. I'm going to give them to you right up front. First of all, in verses 1 through 4, he says, "Elders, shepherd God's flock." Then he says, "Church, follow your leaders," in verse 5. And then he says, "Everyone, clothe yourself with humility." And that's what we're going to talk about this morning. So, chapter 5, verse 1, he begins by saying, "Elders, shepherd God's flock." Look at it, chapter 5, verse 1. "So I exhort the elders among you as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed, shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight." So who are these elders? Well, the whole idea of elders reaches way back into the Old Testament, all the way back to Moses, when Moses appointed 70 elders to help him lead the children of Israel when they were in the wilderness. And the office of elder continued through the Old Testament and into the New Testament church, where there were two formal offices in the New Testament church. One is elders and the other is deacons, which, by the way, that is how we are structured here at Fellowship Greenville. The New Testament pattern is that a church is led by a plurality of leaders, not by one man and not by majority vote. The church is not to be governed by a dictator, nor is it to be governed by a democracy, but the church is governed by God-called, biblically qualified leaders who are affirmed by the congregation. So Fellowship Greenville is led by elders, and we have deacons, and our pastors are also considered to be elders as well. But what is most important to see here is how Peter tells the elders to lead. He tells them to lead like a shepherd. Lead like a shepherd. So what does it look like? What does it mean to lead like a shepherd rather than a CEO, for example? What kind of leader is needed to lead the church today as our society becomes more and more hostile toward our faith? Well, actually, the need is the same as it's always been. Godly leadership always follows the same pattern, and that is a follower of Jesus who leads others is to lead like a shepherd. A follower of Jesus who leads others is to lead like a shepherd, because you see, a shepherd has a unique leadership style. He doesn't drive his sheep like a cowboy. He doesn't seek to establish himself as the alpha dog barking orders to everybody. He doesn't treat his people like assets to be managed and maximized like a CEO of a publicly traded company. A shepherd's leadership style is different. Now, that doesn't mean that the shepherd is not a strong leader. He is a strong leader. A shepherd doesn't, for example, doesn't always ask the sheep where they want to go. He might lead them to a place that they're not quite sure of, or maybe not even like. And so if you are a ministry leader or you aspire to become one, what Peter writes here applies to you. And it doesn't matter if the group you lead is large or small or young or old or filled with people who have been following Jesus a long time or filled with people who are just getting started. I think sometimes that we forget that the early church primarily met in homes. There were very few large churches, and no large churches like this are the ones that the really mega churches that are out there today. Nothing like that. Because you remember, the ancient culture was not a highly mobile culture, and that meant that most churches were simply neighborhood gatherings of believers. And that means that almost every passage that's addressed to New Testament leaders was written to folks who were leading the equivalent of a modern-day overgrown small group, say 10, 20, 30, 40 people at max. And these leaders had no Bible. Think about that. No Bible and no formal training. First century house churches didn't have seminary-trained pastors, governing boards, or paid staff members. The churches were led by shopkeepers and tradesmen and farmers, regular folks who simply considered it a great privilege to be able to shepherd a small portion of God's flock. So what Peter writes here applies to the elders of this church and all other local churches for that matter, but it also applies to group leaders and church planters and missionaries and all other kinds of ministry leaders. And so the point, though, is that a follower of Jesus who leads others, their leadership style is that of a shepherd. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. Now, shepherding God's people is a huge concept for Peter. And think about this, those of you that have been around the church for a long time. Why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think Peter would focus on shepherding as his primary model of leadership? Well, you remember Peter spent a lot of time around Jesus, and he refers to that when he says in verse 1, I'm a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ. And after Christ suffered and died and rose from the dead, Jesus and Peter had a significant conversation that had a huge impact on Peter's life and his philosophy of ministry. You may remember that Peter actually denied knowing Jesus three times after Jesus was arrested. And no doubt, after the resurrection, no doubt Peter was overwhelmed with guilt as he stood before the risen Christ that he had betrayed. But despite his failure, Jesus calls Peter back into the ministry, and it's back into a ministry of shepherding. Here's the conversation in John chapter 21. He says, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he said, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said, feed my lambs. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter said, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And he said, tend my sheep. He said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he asked him a third time, do you love me? And Peter said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Now, do you think Peter would remember that conversation? I think so. I mean, three times he had denied Jesus. Now Jesus gives him three times to affirm his love for him. And Jesus says, if you love me, not if you love the sheep, if you love me, he says, feed my lambs, take care of my sheep, feed my sheep. So it's no wonder that Peter's model of leadership was a shepherding model. Now, remember the context. The church was beginning to experience the first waves of a huge storm of persecution that was about to hit the church. And no doubt, the leaders of these house churches were experiencing the same insults and ridicule as the people that they were caring for, but probably to an even greater degree. And there are two very real temptations for leaders who personally experience suffering in ministry. The first temptation is to run away and save yourself, and Peter knows something about that. The second is to lead with wrong motives, and I believe Peter addresses both of those temptations in this passage right here. So when he says, elders, church leaders, shepherd God's flock, exercising oversight, I think one of the things that he's implying there, one of the things he's saying is, stay at your post. You continue entrusting yourself to God. You continue doing what is right. You continue to live out your calling to shepherd God's people. You lay down your life for the sheep. Jesus said in John chapter 10, verse 11, I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd does not own the sheep, so when he sees the wolf coming and abandons the sheep and runs away. And the wolf attacks the flock and scatters them. He runs away because he's a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. Now, no doubt in my mind that Peter has Jesus' words in mind as he pens these words here in chapter 5, what we call chapter 5. Because he reminds us he's a witness of the sufferings of the sheep, the chief shepherd. A witness to Jesus giving his life for the sheep. And so he tells the elders to stay at your post. Why? Because in times of increasing hostility, those who lead make themselves vulnerable to attack by being visible in leadership. Think about this. More and more today, evangelism, sharing your faith with people outside the faith, more and more evangelism is considered unacceptable. In fact, when good works are combined with evangelism, it is viewed by the cultural elite of our day as despicable, deceptive, subversive behavior. Like in 2015, the Roman Catholic Church announced that Mother Teresa would be canonized. She'd be made a saint. And that really wasn't a surprise. But what was a surprise was the harsh criticism that she received and the church received. Back in 1975, Time Magazine did she was on the cover of Time Magazine for her good works among the poor in India. But in 2015, just 40 years later, the cultural elite did not consider her good works good anymore. They saw the good done by Mother Teresa as a deceptive ruse to hide her real desire to proselytize and spread her dogmatic religious views. And the mainstream media criticized her and the church. Now, I want you to think about that. The idea that evangelism is no longer an acceptable goal for a pastor, a church leader, an evangelist, a missionary, or even a Christian, the cultural consensus that sharing your faith with others is a despicable, deceptive activity, that puts church leaders at risk in the days ahead. But that's not all. More and more, holding on to and teaching biblical values, even within the confines of a sermon or talking about it in a Bible study group, can be labeled as hate speech. It can be considered not just politically incorrect, but it can be considered criminal. And there have been cases brought against pastors of churches because of what has been preached from the pulpit, and that's not going to go away either. Hear me, the die is cast. The question is not if the growing cultural hostility against biblical values will continue, but how quickly it will continue. And election cycles and judicial appointments speed up or slow down the process. But the lessons of history are undeniable. The elite framework of our culture, media, higher education, and Hollywood are all in alignment against traditional values, and it's only a matter of time until the rest of the culture falls into line. And Peter says to the elders, to the leaders of the churches, don't give in to the temptation to shrink back, to run away, to hide. Don't give up. Stay at your post, he says. Shepherd God's flock. Care for them. Watch over them. Protect them. Lead and guide God's flock. Now, I want to just tell you, that is what our lay elders and vocational pastors and small group leaders do here at Fellowship Greenville. They watch over you and take care of you, and they pray for you and your families. They're here to lead and guide and provide for the flock. And let me just tell you, your leaders love Jesus, and they love you, and they love serving you. And I have never in my life served with a finer group of leaders than we have here at Fellowship Greenville. And I'm so humbled that I get a chance to serve alongside of these great men and women. Now, the second thing, so the first temptation is to run away and hide. The second temptation is to serve with wrong motives. And that's why Peter gives us three attitudes that are essential to every shepherd's job description. Look back at verse 2 again. He says, shepherd the flock of God under your care, not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you. Not for shameful gain, but eagerly. Not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. So he's saying, watch out for wrong motives by cultivating these three key shepherding attitudes. He says, shepherd God's people and do it willingly, eagerly, and humbly. Do it willingly, eagerly, and humbly. First, shepherd God's people willingly, not because you have to. He's saying, don't lead out of obligation. Lead because you want to, because it's a privilege. You don't have to. I'm not beyond complaining sometimes in ministry, but sometimes I have met some pastors, and every time I'm around them, they just complain and complain and complain. And I have even actually looked at them and said, why don't you just quit? You don't have to do this, you know. Just quit. And they look at me like, well, I can't quit. Well, you can't quit complaining, so quit. I mean, you know, do it willingly, not because you have to. All pastors complain. Don't let me, but anyway. Second, do it eagerly, not to get, but to give. Now, in those days, just like today, some pastors and elders were financially supported by the churches they served. And Peter is saying, make sure that the work you do as a shepherd doesn't become a business. He's saying, feed the sheep, don't feed off the sheep. Third, shepherd God's people humbly, not lording it over people. Now, right here, I believe Peter begins to develop a thought that's going to permeate everything he says in the next five verses. Not domineering, not lording it over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock. And the thing I appreciate about Peter is he practices what he preaches here, because when he exhorts these elders and the churches that he's writing to, he doesn't throw his apostolic weight around. You notice in verse 1 he says, I exhort you as a fellow elder, and a partner with you in the glory that's coming. So Peter is modeling humility there. Now here's the deal. If a church leader has to always be in control, if he has to always have full agreement from everyone, or if he comes across with a superior attitude, that's a mark of insecurity and immaturity, and that leader is out of line. I mean, the fact is, some people want to be in positions of leadership because of ego, because they want to be considered important, they want to be noticed, and they're demanding and they're bossy, and Peter is saying that is not the way of Jesus. His is the way of the washbowl and the towel. You lead by serving, you lead by example, and you lead humbly. And again, I want to tell you, you have that kind of leadership here at Fellowship Greenville. Lay leaders, staff elders, deacons, small group leaders, those who serve in leadership, I can tell you they willingly, eagerly, and humbly serve you. Now, I'm not saying we don't get frustrated sometimes. I'm not saying we get it right all the time. But when we don't get it right, we're humble enough to admit where we've gotten off base. And listen, the fact that we have a plurality of leaders here, that is a great safeguard, because if one of us gets out of line, the rest of us will call that person back into line. And we have created a culture here that we can speak into each other's lives, and it's very, very healthy because of that. Now, let me push pause for just a second, because there are a lot of reasons that leaders need to cultivate these attitudes of being willing and eager and humble. But maybe the most important one is kind of like the most obvious one when you think about it. But the most obvious reason that shepherds need to be willing, eager, and humble is because people are like sheep, right? People are like sheep. What do I mean by that? I mean people wander. They wander away. So here's how a sheep wanders. A sheep's over here and is eating a tuft of grass, and he's just enjoying himself so much, and he's just, I mean, this is the best grass. I'm so glad the shepherd has brought us here to have this grass. So he eats that little tuft of grass, and then he's like, oh, there's another one over there. So he goes over here, and there's another tuft of grass, and so he's like, yeah, eating. He just loves that tuft of grass, and it's like, oh, this is just the best grass. I just love it, and I love it. And he finishes that up, and he's, oh. And so now the sheep's over here, you know, and like, he's wandered away. Now, he doesn't wander away because he's a bad sheep or because he's a mean sheep. He didn't do it intentionally. He was just kind of feeding himself, and he got wandered and wandered farther and farther away. He didn't intend to get lost. It just kind of wandered away. People are like that. We wander. We don't mean to get in trouble. That wasn't our intention. We didn't mean to get lost, but all of a sudden it's like, you know, we eat and we wander, and all of a sudden, where am I? Like, how did it get here? Now, here's the thing. That's the way sheep are. And you know that because you got a sheep heart, too. I got a sheep heart. Yeah, now, here's the thing. If you're going to lead like a shepherd, you got to remember that people are like sheep. They tend to wander. And here's the difficult thing to come to grips with. You can't always prevent it. You cannot always prevent it. You can't herd sheep, drive sheep, the way a cowboy drives cattle. A cowboy drives cattle from behind, barking orders from behind, hemming the cattle in with other cowboys and yipping dogs, trying to keep them in line. A shepherd leads from the front. But still, some may wander away. I mean, even Jesus lost one. And you, again, you know that's true because you know your own heart. You've got a sheep heart. I got a sheep heart. I got a wandering heart. Now, the hard lesson that I continue to try to learn after all these years in ministry is that I have to adapt my leadership to meet the sheep where they are rather than be frustrated that they're not where they should be. Let me say that again. As a shepherd of God's flock, you need to adapt your leadership to meet the sheep where they are rather than continually be frustrated that they're not where you think they should be. Now, you work hard, you lead, you guide, you give your life to lead people and care for them and watch over them, but sometimes they wander away. Sometimes they don't move at the same speed you would like them to, so you've got to adapt your leadership to where people are rather than just be frustrated with a sheep because they're not where you want them to be. And there's a great promise that goes along with this shepherding role, and that is verse 4, when the chief shepherd appears, you'll receive the unfading crown of glory. Now that is an amazing promise, isn't it? And so all you under shepherds, listen to this. The chief shepherd is coming, and he promises that he will reward your faithfulness. A shepherd leader ought to have verse 4 underlined. That's your promise. If you're teaching, encouraging, and leading, this is your promise. If you are discouraged, this is your promise. Because listen, God sees your work. He knows every single hour of preparation you put in. He knows the nights you stay up late dealing with someone who's hurting and brokenhearted. He knows every phone call you make, every email that you write, every prayer that you pray, every dollar that you spend, every meal that you prepare. He knows when your hard work goes unnoticed and unappreciated. He knows every sacrifice that you may have made on behalf of his sheep, and he knows how hard the work is at times. He knows your frustrations and your struggles. He knows how when that time, when things got really tough and you thought about quitting, but by the grace of God, you didn't quit and you stayed your post. And he promises when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. Now, I have no idea what that means. I don't know. I have no idea what that is, but I know this. Whatever it is, he's saying, you'll see. It'll be worth it. It'll be worth it. It's worth the sacrifice to be a part of shepherding God's flock. It's worth the investment you're making. And by the way, if you want to get in on that reward, we can always use more shepherds. We can always use more small group leaders and more community group leaders. So if you want to get in on the reward, then stop by the next step table, and we can get you plugged in. Now, I know many of you are bored right now. You're not paying attention because you're saying, well, all this is about leadership, and I'm not a leader, and you're talking to elders and pastors and small group leaders, but I'm just a normal sheep. I'm not a leader. And so I just want to take a moment and acknowledge that's what's going on in the room. And I want to push back just a little bit and say, really? You say you're not a leader, Dad, but is someone watching you? You say you're not a leader, Mom, but is somebody watching you? You say you're not a leader, Granddad, but is somebody watching you? You say you're not a leader, Teacher, but is somebody watching you? You turn around and look behind you, and if there are people that are watching you and observing your life, you're leading. It's like this. Imagine you're going down the interstate, and it's one of those days where it is just raining cats and dogs, pouring rain, windshield wipers just going crazy on high speed. You can't see anything ahead of you, and you slow down to like this crawl because it's just pouring rain, and you're wondering, well, should I just pull over or should I keep going? I mean, how many of you know what I'm talking about? You've been in those kind of, you know, it's like a whiteout, a watery whiteout. You can't see anything. So you're driving along, and all of a sudden you see up ahead, you see some taillights. Now, they're dim, but you see them up ahead, and as soon as you see those taillights, you're kind of relieved a little bit because you can actually see something now, and as you get closer to the taillights, you feel a little more comfortable because you're following someone who knows where they're going. Well, maybe they know where they're going, or maybe they're just following the taillights of the person in front of them, but nevertheless, you feel more relaxed because you're following someone. Now, here's the point. All of us have taillights. And life is difficult, and sometimes it's overwhelming for all of us. It rains hard on all of our lives. And when it does, don't be surprised if someone is watching your taillights. More of you are leaders than think you're leaders. So this shepherding leadership mindset has broader application than just church leaders. It applies to Dad the family shepherd, or Mom the family shepherd, or Bob the business shepherd. The leadership style of a follower of Jesus is that of a shepherd. Now, speaking of broader application, that's exactly where Peter goes next. Verse 5, likewise, you who are younger, be subject to the elders. So everything I've said so far is point number one, all right? Anybody remember point number two? I know it was a long, long time ago. Point number two is very simple. It's just simply this. Church, follow your leaders. Church, follow your leaders. He says, in the same way, in what way? In the same way that church leaders should not try to dominate the flock, in the same way you younger, or think of it this way, everyone who is not in leadership in the church, in the same way church, don't try to dominate or wrestle control away from those in leadership. Rather, what does he say? He says, be subject to the elders. Now, here's all I want to say about this. Here's all I want to say about this point. I've been here for 22 years, and I am truly humbled by how this congregation, by how you have so faithfully followed the leadership and the direction of the elders as the elders have sought the leadership of the Spirit for this church. I'm humbled by that. Every major directional decision the elders have brought to you for a vote has passed by 92% or better, most of the time 95% or better. Now, do you have any idea how rare that is? I mean, that never happened in the churches that I grew up in. I mean, if you got 52% of the vote in some big vote, you were excited about it, which meant that almost half of the people were against it. But we've never had factions or charter members who've tried to exert pressure on this body or the leadership. And again, in the Baptist churches I grew up in, sadly, that kind of thing happened all the time. So thank you for modeling verse 5. Thank you, thank you, thank you for how you live out verse 5. So elders, shepherd the flock, church, follow your leaders. Number 3, everyone, clothe yourself with humility. Now, middle of verse 5, this is really the key to the whole thing. To my thinking, it's the controlling idea of the entire passage. He says, clothe yourself, all of you, see that? All of you, clothe yourselves. Leaders and followers, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. So what does it mean to clothe yourself with humility toward one another? Why does Peter emphasize humility above everything else as hostility against the church is increasing? Because, think about this, because when leaders lead with humility, it's not hard for followers to follow. And when followers follow with humility, it's not hard for leaders to lead. So the key to unity and harmony in the church is humility. Now, all of you drove to church this morning in something. You came in a car, a truck, God forbid, a minivan, I mean, I had to drive a minivan for like 20 years. So, like, or a Jeep, like I got to drive this morning. And you came here in some kind of vehicle, and inside the engine of that vehicle, there are hundreds of metal parts that are constantly rubbing against each other and banging against each other, metal parts against each other, and that's how power is produced in that engine. And your motor would disintegrate from heat and friction in a matter of moments if it were not for one important substance, which is oil, not gasoline, but oil. Oil. Your motor would freeze up and shut down without oil. Oil is the lubricant that allows all those metal parts to function normally without building up excess heat. Oil reduces friction and drag. It reduces wear and tear and greatly enhances the life of your engine. So buy Pennzoil. No, it's not a commercial. It's not a commercial. It's kind of like the 17-year-old, you know, who saw the red light flashing on her dashboard, but she ignored it and burned the engine up. And her dad said, "Didn't you see the little red oil can flashing, flashing, flashing?" She said, "Yeah, I saw it. I just didn't think it was important." Now, oil is important. Now, in a church, in this church, there are hundreds of semi-abrasive moving parts that rub against each other in order for our body to function. And without humility, without this one vital commodity, there would be constant friction and heat buildup and wear and tear and ultimately breakdown. And a lack of humility is really what takes most churches down. When I was a little boy, I remember my dad's primary service station was the Humble Oil gas station. And I remember this so well. But anybody remember Humble Oil? A few. I had a guy in the first service come up and he goes, "In my office," he's a business guy, he said, "In my office, I've got an old sign, Humble Oil." I thought that was pretty cool. Peter says, look, as your church goes through difficult times, as your people face growing hostility, as things heat up, the way to survive together is to apply the oil of humility in your relationships. Peter says, clothe yourself with humility. So what does a wardrobe of humility look like? Well, humility defers to others, doesn't demand its own way. Humility doesn't insist on being right all the time, doesn't have this "I'm better than you" attitude. Humility doesn't go around trying to set everybody straight, doesn't put others down to build itself up. Humility, though, breeds cooperation, team spirit. Everybody has a part to say. And humility gives grace to each other. Humility is the oil of moving hearts. Now, there is a huge, big reason why this is so important, and it's found there in verse 5. Because why do we clothe ourselves with humility? Because God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. So it's right up here on the screen. We're going to memorize it this morning, okay? We're going to do a little scripture memory, all right? So let's say it with me. 1 Peter 5:5. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Again, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. One more time. Now close your eyes and say it. God opposes the proud and gives grace to the humble. All right. Hey, what about March Madness? Anybody watching basketball? I mean, were the games yesterday like the best games that you've ever seen in your life? I mean that Carson Edwards guy, absolutely incredible guy. And then like just think about the weather this week. The weather was really good, and you know, until today, and we're back to rain and cold, which I like. But anyway, so hey, what's 1 Peter 5:5? Yes, God opposes the proud, but gives grace. That is such a powerful passage. Should be something that leaders quote to yourselves, followers quote to you. Pride is a poison. It kills everything it touches. So he's saying the leaders in the community should not be prideful, and the church itself should not be prideful, because Very good. God opposes the proud, and we don't want God against us, do we? Verse 6, so humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you. Now, the question is, how do you do that? I mean, because can we make ourselves more humble? Can you make yourself, like, I'm humble and proud of it, you know, that kind of thing. You know, are you right? What's that book that somebody wrote one time? Like, here's my book, and it's, you know, How I Achieve Humility or something like that. Yeah, how does that work? Well, you can't really make yourself humble. It's got to be the work of the Spirit, right? But okay, but here we're commanded to humble ourselves. We're commanded to clothe ourselves with humility. So there's got to be something we're supposed to do to cooperate with the work of the Spirit in our lives. And I think these two verses tell us two things we must do or know to cooperate with the Spirit's work to cultivate humility. Look at it again, verse 6. Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. So first of all, humility grows from seeing God's mighty hand behind everything that's happening to you. Humility is cultivated. It grows when you see that God's mighty hand is behind everything that's happening to you. I think that ties back to chapter 4, verse 19, where we're told that there are times when we suffer according to the will of God. So humility reminds us that it is God's hand that is at work in our lives, filing and chiseling and sometimes pounding away on us to make us more like Jesus. And this humility reminds us that it is God's hand that is orchestrating what is going on even in our culture today. We might not understand it, but you can't say that God's not in it. It's not happening beyond his control. The proud person tries to get out from under that hand. The proud person resists what God is doing and tries to find his or her own way out. But a person who allows the Spirit to cultivate humility sees God at work in every situation of life. Now, the second thing is found in verse 7, where Peter says, casting all your cares on him because he cares for you. And I know this is a favorite verse for many people. And they treat this verse, they basically will quote it, cast your cares on him because he cares for you. But actually, have you ever thought about the fact, have you ever connected the thought of casting your cares on him to the idea of humility? Because the verb is humble yourself, casting all your cares on him. So how do the two go together? Well, we're told here that humility grows from casting our cares on God rather than us trying to carry them ourselves. Proud people try to carry the burdens themselves to the last minute, and then they finally go, okay, God, I guess you'll have to take it from here. So trying to carry your burdens yourself, that's a mark of pride. And pride doesn't work because? Right, so here's the point. A person who cultivates a humble spirit accepts that there are some things that you can't change. And those things that you can't change that make life harder for you, you take those things, the suffering, the frustrations, and you cast them back to God. You give them back to God. So believers who are growing in humility are learning to cast their cares on God because they know that even though God's hand sometimes allows painful events to come into our lives, they know and they rest in and rely on the fact that God cares for them even in the midst of those painful times. Okay, so it's time to land the plane. All right, summary. As Peter cares for his friends who are facing growing hostility, he instructs the church on how to live and to lead in these tough times. First, he speaks to church leaders. He says, elders, shepherd God's flock, stay at your post, lead, guide, care for, watch over, protect God's flock. Don't allow the pressures that you experience as a leader to cause you to run away. Don't serve God and shepherd people for the wrong motives, but be willing, eager, and humble, and then look to the future, know that your work will be rewarded. Second, he speaks to the church and he says, simply, church, just follow your leaders. And third, he says to everyone, clothe yourself with humility. And why is humility so important? Okay. So Peter doesn't say it right here, but Jesus is all over this passage because he's a witness to the sufferings of Christ. He's looking for the chief shepherd to come back. I was reading this. I picked a book off my shelf. It's a classic book. If you haven't never read the Andrew Murray's book on humility, it'd be something that you need to do. Andrew Murray says this. He says, our one need is to study and know and trust the life that has been revealed in Christ. That's our life. It's the life that's now ours. So it is of supreme importance that we have a correct understanding of who Christ is, especially what may be counted as his chief characteristic, the root and essence of all his character as our Redeemer. He says there can only be one answer. It is his humility. What is the incarnation but his heavenly humility, his emptying himself and becoming a man? What is his life on earth but humility, taking the form of a servant? And what is his atonement but humility, that he humbled himself and became obedient unto death? And what is his ascension and his glory but humility, exalted to the throne and crowned with glory? He humbled himself, wherefore God also highly exalted him. In heaven where he was with the Father, in his birth, in his life, in his death, and it is sitting on the throne, it is all humility. It is nothing but humility. And then he says this, Christ is the humility of God embodied in human nature. You ever think about God being humble? Christ is the humility of God embodied in human nature. And then he asks, what would happen if believers permanently were guided by the humility of Jesus? What if all our relationships were oiled with humility? How would that change what's going on in your home? How would that change what's going on in maybe the ministry that you tend to? How would that change what's going on in your business? How would it change that relationship that's really, really... there's so much friction there. Jesus says, come to me, learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls.